You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Tam 9, are you ready? No, come on, Tam 9, are you ready? Let me hear you say SGU. Let me hear you say SGU.
SGU.
Let's get ready to reason! Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe!
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, July 15th, 2011, and I am your host, Stephen Novella. With me, as usual, is Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. Switch.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Ciao, Tam 9.
Ciao, Bella.
No, not ciao, Bella. No, not ciao.
No,
ciao is how you say good morning in Vietnamese.
Vietnamese, not Italian?
Good morning, Vietnam! All right, we normally record at night, so it's very rare we get to do this in the morning, so I had to take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's your only chance to say good morning in another language.
Pretty much.
Good. What happened on July 23rd?
Comet C199501 was discovered by astronomer Alan Hale and amateur astronomer Thomas Bopp. And we know this comet famously as...
The Bopp comet.
As the comet passed perihelion on April 1st, 1997, the comet developed into an incredible sight, something I'll never forget, certainly. It shone brighter in the sky than any other star except Sirius. Its dust tail stretched 40 to 45 degrees across the sky, and it was visible well before the sky got dark each night and remained visible really throughout the night. Do you guys remember?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, here's the thing. It was November of 1996 when amateur astronomer Chuck Schremek took a CCD image of the comet, which showed a fuzzy, slightly elongated object nearby. And when his computer sky viewing program did not identify the star, Schremek called up Art Bell.
That's the first person I would call.
Yeah, absolutely. Who's the host of the Coast to Coast AM radio show, to announce he had discovered a Saturn-like object following the comet. UFO enthusiasts soon concluded that there was an alien spacecraft following the comet. Now, here's what comes next. A few months later...
Not up to July yet?
Not quite yet. But a few months later, March 1997, 39 members of the Heaven's Gate cult, led by Marshall Applewhite... committed suicide. They believed that their souls would rise up to board the supposed spaceship following the comet. And of course, we in the skeptical movement often point to the Heaven's Gate cult as a shining example of how belief in paranormal and pseudoscience can have the most dire consequences.
He has those sane eyes, you know.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen the previews yet for The Rise of the Apes? Looks awesome. Oh, where you have the chimpanzee who looks sentient. You know, just the way the eyes look, he looks more sentient than this guy.
This guy was out to lunch, literally.
So, figuratively.
Not literally, metaphorically. We don't know that. For sure.
I'm sure at some point in time he was literally out to lunch, but that's not in that picture.
He went out to buy sneakers or something.
Didn't he call himself like Do Re Mi or something?
Do Peep or something?
Do, I believe it was.
Bo.
Yes.
Bo Peep, yeah, right.
Well, thank you for that chipper this day in history. It's a good way to start off Tam.
But wait, it's Tam 9 from Outer Space.
That's right.
Outer Space.
I see the connection.
Make the most of it.
We will pause for this opportunity to thank the JREF for having us on once again, allowing us to be sponsors this year. Thank you to DJ and Randy, who have been very supportive of our show. Now, Evan, there's actually another comet-related news item.
Yeah, it just so happens that some news was made last week regarding Comet Elenin. For those of you who are not aware, that Comet Elenin is coming to our inner solar system in the fall of this year.
Coming to an inner solar system near you.
Very near you. Well, maybe not that near. The comet was first detected in December 2010 by Russian astronomer Leonid Elenin. And, of course, when you discover a comet, you get to name the comet. It's a long-period comet, And a lot of people are associating this comet with end-of-the-world prophecies of various sorts. Some think that it's in conjunction with the fictional planet Nibiru, or Planet X as we know it, and others believe it's the prophecy of a Nostradamus quatrain, when Nostradamus wrote, "Thirst and famine will come when the comet passes."
Which could literally apply to any comet.
Well, yes, of course. There were no real dates associated with Nostradamus.
So when I looked at that picture, the first thing I thought was, it's a photographic anomaly.
Yeah, we'll get there. That would be a reasonable hypothesis.
Elenin is a rather ordinary comet. It's going to come to our inner solar system, yes, but it's not going to really come anywhere near the Earth. About as close as it's going to get is 22 million miles away, roughly 100 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. And we're not even really going to see it. You're going to need a pretty powerful telescope. You're going to need to be in the southern hemisphere in the dark of night, and you might be able to pick it up. So they're predicting it's not going to be some hale-bopp spectacular.
You know, when I first saw this picture, I thought, it's got to be a photographic anomaly.
That would be a reasonable hypothesis. I think that's the hypothesis that everyone, though, has come up with, Evan, right? I mean, there are some scientists who have an alternate hypothesis.
There are, you know, from around the world, depending on who you speak to. There's Chinese astronomers who have their opinions on what's going on. Russians, Argentinians, I've even astronomers have chimed in on this. But it just wouldn't be TAM-9 from outer space if the name Richard Hoagland wasn't mentioned at least once. So I'm fulfilling
Hoagland.
So I am fulfilling that quota right now. Yes, Mr. Face on Mars himself has chimed in with his opinions about this comet. And just last week, he made comments that has the end of the world crowd abuzz.
He thinks it's a photographic artifact?
Well, he's putting two and two together and coming up with like 50.
Yeah.
Which is typical math for
new
him.
New math.
He's defending the reports of cranks around the world that there are intelligent forces at work behind this comet. I mean, literally behind this comet.
But there are no intelligent forces behind his opinion.
Now, Hoagland's referring to comments made by a gentleman, an Argentinian astronomer, Sergio Toscano, who is quoted as having said the following. Behind the comet, discovered in December last year, Chinese scientists say it's something they call a cluster, which means globular cluster, or perhaps alien spacecraft.
Yeah.
Probably the latter.
So I read about some various explanations of exactly what these dots are. So the dot that's alone in the center of the picture is the comet itself. But what are these lines of four dots to either side of the comet? What is that? So one possible explanation I read claimed that those eight dots have to do with the comet's coma, or its tail, and that the photograph just interpreted its tail this way and just came out in the photograph that way, which is, you know, not a bad explanation, but there is an even far simpler explanation.
It was a...
No.
Nope. I called in some help, Phil Plait, of course, and with about 1 minute of his time, he informed me that those eight dots of light behind the comet are just simply background stars. Now, there are two stars, to be precise, all right, one to its top and one to its bottom, but when taking a picture of a comet and you focus on the comet, you know, throughout a long camera exposure, other objects in the background that are not moving, or at least not moving relative to the comet's movement, will show up multiple times in a row.
There are four lights!
Oh my God, it's very nice.
Yeah, the comet is moving with respect to the background stars. So when you focus on the comet, the background stars spread out. It's of a, what do you call that, photographic artifact?
I've heard that mentioned somewhere.
I can definitely, you know, to the uneducated eye, though, if I saw this and I was, you know, Hoagland or whatever, I would be like, no, wait, look at it. They're distinct. There's definitely something there. It's not like...
Well, yeah, I mean, they're regular, they're spaced out, they're in formation, if you will. Yeah, so you look at that, and if you thought that that was a true photograph without artifacts, you wouldn't think that that was a natural thing. But Hoagland is famous for that. He looks at, like, the pixelation in photographs and thinks that, oh, look, it's a perfect square. No, it's a pixel, you idiot. That's his, you know, MO. Right?
How big would the ship have to be at the distance? And, you know, if you know the distance...
Don't get technical. Come on. Yeah, big.
That's what we do.
It would be massive. A blogger at the age of autism, Kent Heckenlively, published a blog post a few days ago in which he referred to those who promote science-based medicine and vaccinations, like we're doing here at the conference, as the forces of darkness. In fact, that music came up on the website. So he wrote, there's a few pull-out quotes from what he wrote. "I now know why they fear us so much. I can't prove it, and as a lawyer I understand that's the real show, but I know."
What is this, some kind of Jenny McCarthy, mommy's intuition kind of
thing? "I feel it in my bones."
Whenever you see this kind of rhetoric, this is a huge red flag. And this is the culture now over in the anti-vaccine movement and specifically Age of Autism. They are utterly convinced that there is a dark conspiracy of skeptics, scientists, doctors, big pharma.
Atheists,
absolutely. And the government to poison and kill kids. Right? We know we're doing that. It's completely evil. We are the forces of darkness. And he has seen the pattern. He has connected the dots. And that's what he does. He looks for any tenuous connection among skeptics and other scientists or pharmaceutical industry, and he weaves that into one massive dark conspiracy. And now he knows he's seen the truth. The disconnect there is that he can't prove it, but he still knows that it's true. Of course, not understanding that if you can't prove it, no, you don't know it. Those two things kind of go hand in hand, but that is the conspiracy mindset.
But when he says, "I know that they fear us."
Well, he thinks that we're afraid they're gonna essentially blow the conspiracy on us. That we're trying to keep them down because they're gonna blow the whistle on us. And they are all waiting for the day of revelation when they succeed. When they write about this, and they all talk about this, when the day comes, it's like the second coming of Christ, when the forces of darkness are laid low and they reveal us for what they are, then they'll be hell to pay. They literally talk in those fire and brimstone apocalyptic terms. And so here's the next quote. "The dark forces which in the past have destroyed the careers of those who have found clues to the afflictions of our children and other disease communities are once again on the move." He didn't say what specifically he was talking about, and in the comments to the blog, he says things which suggest it's about something specific, which has nothing to do generally with us. But again, this still reveals the mindset. And he's an editor at Age of Autism. This isn't just some random, comment or blogger.
And aren't these the same? Isn't this the same blog that photoshopped the picture of you eating a baby for Thanksgiving?
Yes. A baby for Thanksgiving. Right, that's right.
How was that anyway?
It was
tender.
Jack cranberry sauce.
A little gravy, just if you get the temperature just right. Yep. And then he quotes Psalm 94. There's a lot of biblical God references throughout his blog post. "He will repay them for their iniquity and wipe them out for their wickedness. The Lord God will wipe them out." And so, again, they talk about this conflict with the scientific community in these apocalyptic terms. And this is not an isolated case. This is their mindset. So it's important, I think, for us to recognize, and like David Gorski and others with us at Science-Based Medicine very frequently comment on the fact that, we're content to believe that most of the people who disagree with us are just wrong. They're misinformed. They're not critical thinkers. We don't necessarily believe that they're all evil or that they have nefarious goals. Yeah, there are
some of them are evil.
There are con artists in the mix. Of course, con artists are going to take advantage of fantasy land whenever they can. But the rank and file are just misinformed, and we're happy to engage with them on the evidence and the logic, because that's where the discussion should be taking place. But they don't give us that same courtesy. They think we're the forces of darkness, imposing evil on the world.
Well, saying that we want to engage them with logic and they refuse is like saying we want to have a sword fight and they don't have a sword. So of course they don't want to engage us with logic. They don't have it on their side.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's right. And that's why they go for the ad hominems, the conspiracies, the logical fallacies. If they had the science on their side, they wouldn't have to do that. I agree. So for those of you who were here yesterday, those of us who were at the tables...
Yeah, Steve, I was there when this,
now,
guy...
Tell us what happened, Bob.
This guy came over, and he seemed to be going from table to table. Mike and I were sitting there, and this guy came over and said, and he handed us his thing, and I just thought he was a fellow skeptic who was handing some literature that we'd be interested in, and he said, here, Carl Sagan would want you to read this. So I'm like, oh, thanks a lot, appreciate it. And I started reading, I'm like, oh, no, and I just kind of chucked it a bit, but...
Science confirms the Bible. It's funny, I mean, in the way they proselytize, they tip their hand, Carl Sagan would want you to read this. As if he's our prophet, right? That's how they think. They think, so yeah, your prophet. That's why, like, when they go after evolution, they're going after Darwin, the prophet of evolution. Or when they try to build a case against evolution, for example, they do it quote by quote, not study by study or evidence by evidence, but quote by quote, because that's how they think. That's how they build their case. It's all quotes and authority from the Bible and based upon the authority and the righteousness or whatever of their prophets. So it's funny how they reveal how they think. When they engage with us, they use their own tactics as if that's going to be persuasive to us. And then when we counter that, it's like we're talking past each other because we're talking, you know, logic and evidence, you know, which is apparently not what they talk. But did any of you get this card? Any of you see this card being passed around? I believe that the ultimate source of this from looking online is Ray the Banana Man Comfort, Living Waters.
Ray Comfort was here?
Yeah.
I missed him.
Damn. No, it is him. It's not. We're not guessing. We looked it up. It's right. Definitely from his group. So his people were actually in this building yesterday.
So we thought we'd take a moment to look a little bit deeper at some of the claims they're making. The basic format here is the Bible makes a certain claim. The science at the time believed something different, but now we know, science today knows that the Bible was right all along. So that's how they reason. But in order to make their case, they misinterpret what the Bible said and what science said at the time, and what science says now.
Yeah, but otherwise they got it.
But otherwise,
yeah, that's great. Perfect.
So, for example, they say, oh, at the time, the scientists believed the world was flat. And the Bible said the world was a sphere, and now we know the world was a sphere. And every link in that chain is, in fact, wrong. So the quote from the Bible that proves that the Bible says the earth is a sphere is this: He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers.
Circle is like a sphere.
Yeah, so circle. That's it. The word circle, which is non-specific to dimensionality, that could be a two-dimensional.
Now, wait, Steve, were you reading the King James Version or the New International? Because I'm pretty sure the New International says oblate spheroid.
It does.
I think so. It's just a translation issue.
Right. You could translate circle as oblate spheroid. That's right. I forgot about that one. And grasshopper does mean Homo sapiens. It does.
Yeah. Well, it means Kung Fu Homo sapiens.
They were talking
to ninja.
Nice, Jay.
Well, I say your Kung Fu is good. Mine is better.
So it's also not true that scholars of the time thought the earth was flat. Maybe really ancient cultures might have thought that, but once you get to the Greeks, like the first real, you know, civilization, yeah, they knew that, they figured out that the earth was a sphere. And again, today, as Rebecca said, we know that it's more detailed than that. It's actually an oblate spheroid. The next one's funny. They also say that the Bible says that the stars are countless. At the time, they thought there were only 1,100 stars, and now we know that they're countless. So therefore, the Bible was right. So again, pretty much every component of that chain is wrong. Here's the quote that proves that the Bible knew that the stars were countless. I will make the descendants of David my servant and the Levites who minister before me as countless as the stars of the sky and as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Obviously poetic, right? There's some poetic license there. As countless as the stars was not meant to be a scientific discourse on cosmology.
They just literally couldn't count that high.
Yeah.
That's all.
So... Yeah, so let's take a little bit closer look at it. So if we just ignore the fact that this is poetic, I mean, sand is not measureless either. There's a finite amount of sand. We can roughly calculate if we want to bother to do so. But the stars aren't countless. We've, in fact, counted them, or at least estimated. Does anybody know how many stars there are in the universe?
10 to the 22 to 10 to the 24. Big number.
Yeah, something in there, yeah. The number I found was 9 times 10 to the 21, which seems oddly specific.
Is that Avogadro's number?
Close.
Yeah, it's close.
We can estimate how many stars there are. They're actually not countless, so that's incorrect. That the Bible knew something because of this poetry is a real stretch. And the claim that scientists at the time thought there were only 1,100 stars is also incorrect. There's no reference given for this. There's no source. But the best source we could think of is Ptolemy at the time made some comment to the effect that he's cataloged about 1,100 stars. Not that that's all that there were. You can, in fact, see naked eye many thousands of stars, at least several thousand, more than the 1,100.
Yeah, that happens to be where he was at the time.
Yeah, I mean, well, so it's just, yeah, so every component, it shows the loose scholarship and what we call motivated reasoning.
If you or bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, or bullshit, or motivated bullshit, you could, that if you have the end in mind, if you know where you're trying to get to, human beings are really good at rationalizing their way to a predetermined goal or justifying or rationalizing a belief they already hold. That's what we tend to do. You pick a side and you stick to it no matter what, and we're really good at making up crap in order to defend that position. So you could see even to, combing through the Bible for some poetic reference to stars and then, finagling out of that some kind of a scientific claim. They also knew that the Earth was about the Earth's position in space, right? That's the claim, that the Bible knew about the Earth's position in space.
Center.
Yeah, right. Whereas at the time, scientists thought something else about it. But here's the quote from the Bible. He spreads out the northern skies over empty space. He suspends the Earth over nothing. So what Comfort is claiming is that the phrase, he suspends the Earth over nothing, is an accurate description of cosmology and is conforms to our description of space in some way, which again is a massive, massive stretch. And he goes on like this. Each one is just about as good as this.
And why are they so vague? Like Rebecca said it before, and it made me think, if this is information from God, like why wouldn't he be more accurate?
Yeah, why isn't there like F equals ma in the Bible? Or the mass of an electron. God doesn't know the mass of an electron? Was he holding out on us? I mean, come on.
Kepler's law or something.
Right. There's nothing that's actually detailed enough where it's actually dispositive. It's all vague poetry that you could finagle to mean something it was never intended to.
We're reading an interpreted version of the original.
Yeah, we're multiple steps away from what was originally written. That's right.
Makes his banana comments look, sensible.
All right. Bob, take it away.
Well, a week ago, I was in Jetty Park, in Florida, getting ready to watch the very last, very, very last shuttle launch. And while I was waiting, I couldn't help thinking about 30 years ago, April 12th, I think, 1981, when the very first shuttle took off. I wasn't there for that very first launch, but ever since that day, I promised myself that one day I would get down to Florida and actually watch a live launch. And 3 decades passed, and I still hadn't seen it.
You lazy.
I know, Jay, but the reason is, the big thing is that I was always afraid if you planned a vacation around watching a shuttle launch, there'd be delays, right? It seemed like every shuttle was delayed.
Yeah, there's always an excuse for your procrastination. You had to wait for the very last shuttle launch.
Who saw a shuttle take off? How many
people
here?
I promised myself that I would.
That's right.
I just made that up for this talk, so hang on. So, actually, no. The problem is that the delays, I think, was one of the things that made you think, oh, I'll do it next year, I'll do it the following year. I had a friend at work who actually took a week off from work. He paid like $500 for a ticket to get really close, like 2 miles away from the shuttle. And he went down there, was all excited, and then it was delayed 2 days, 3 days. Finally, he comes home, he didn't see it launch, and I think it launched a couple months later.
And he lost his job, right?
So a few weeks ago, about a month ago, I had a chance to go down to Florida to watch this last launch, and I figured, well, this is the last opportunity I had, so I had to go down there. So, and the people that I were meeting actually had seen launches, they knew where to go, so they were real experts at it. So I went down there, and I landed really late the day before, so we drove to Jetty Park in Cape Canaveral, or near Cape Canaveral. We left around midnight, we got there at 4 in the morning. So after we got there, we parked the car at the best parking spot we can get, and there was not much to do, so we got a couple hours of shut-eye in the car. And then when we woke up, the park was filled with cars and people were walking around. It was just so much excitement, and it was a lot of fun to see. I mean, even the interest and the age range was really interesting. There were senior citizens walking around with NASA T-shirts. There were little kids flying kites shaped like shuttles. So it was just really fascinating. It was also interesting to think about the relationship that different people had with the shuttle. I was with Carol Christian, who was an astrophysicist who, among other things, worked on the Hubble Space Telescope since its inception. Her niece was there, who grew up in a Florida town. I wasn't aware of this, but this town literally, I guess a lot of towns nearby where the shuttle was, they would stop. The entire town would stop. They would leave their house, go outside, and watch the shuttle go off. Like 100 miles away, you could still see this thing take off. Even if they were swimming in the school pool, everyone would run out and watch these things go out. So it was such a part of their life. So clearly, apathy was not a problem, though. The big problem, though, was weather down where we were. It was raining for days. It was overcast. They actually had a 30% chance of favorable weather. So we were anticipating, oh, man, we're going to get down there. They're going to cancel it at the last minute. We'd have to drive 4, 5, 6, 7 hours back because the traffic would be horrendous with a million people over there. But eventually, when we got to about an hour before, they raised the probability to 60% favorable, and we could see the breaks in the sky. So we're like, all right, this is really going to take off, or at least the weather's not going to be a factor. The only other potential problem was mechanical, and I mean, how many mechanical problems could a shuttle have, right? I mean, it's not that complicated, right? So we were standing next to some people who had a NASA feed, and they were listening to the countdown. So 35, 34, 33, 32, 31, hold. They stopped it at 31, and they said something about they needed visible verification. And I looked over.
So then I texted Bob, and I was like, psych! Because I was watching it on my computer at work. And I swear to God, I was like rooting for the breakdown. Because yeah. I wanted to go. I was hoping to delay it a couple weeks till after 10 so I could go.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Sorry, Bob.
That's all right. So I looked over at Carol, and she's shaking her head. I mean, and she knows her stuff. Because visible verification, that means that they've got a window. I didn't know this. There's only a 10-minute window. That shuttle doesn't take off in 10 minutes. That's it. You're not going to launch that day. And I had an image in my mind of this old engineer shuffling off to the shuttle to get a visible ID on what the problem was. I'm like, oh, this thing's... You could eat up that 10 minutes just walking to the shuttle, right? So that's what I'm thinking. And I said to Carol, why don't they just launch this thing, even if it takes 2 hours to fix it? I was getting really frustrated. Just launch it. Who cares? And she's like, Bob, hello, orbital mechanics. You know, when you launch a shuttle, you can't have it chasing the space station. It's got to rendezvous nicely. There's also debris in space that you got to consider because you don't want to be hitting any debris. There's alternate landing sites that have to be prepared. So, I mean, at that window, it makes sense that
there's birds of prey up there, too. Yeah, right. Move around those.
Well, it turned out that it was this thing called the gaseous oxygen vent arm. There was no verification that it actually detached from the shuttle, and that has never happened in every shuttle launch. This has never happened. But actually, there was a closed-circuit camera, I think, they were able to swivel and verify that, yes, this thing has detached, so we're good to go. And then before I knew it, they were doing a countdown, and they got to one even before I was aware of it because I was trying to get my camera ready and stuff. From that distance, though, you could... The flame was incredible. I mean, you see these rockets going up on the 4th of July. This thing was totally amazing. And unfortunately, there was still a lot of cloud cover, and there was a foundation of clouds that it took about 25 seconds to get it to reach. But it was still an amazing sight. Everybody around me was so excited. One thing that surprised me, though, was the sound. It seemed like it took forever for the sound to get to me. I totally forgot that there was being sound produced, and I was just watching this visual, this amazing launch. And then, like, after the shuttle went through the clouds, then this rumble came through that just vibrated your entire body. It was,
you know, about
it was
light
amazing.
Travels faster than sound, right?
I realize that, but it seems...
A little bit faster.
But it travels very fast. I think it would cover 7 miles a lot more quickly than it did.
That's how loud was it? Like, how deep was the vibration?
Recreate it, please.
I won't recreate. You can't recreate that. You can't recreate that.
I bet George could.
I bet he could. I'm clearly not George, but it was your whole body vibrated. It was amazing. One thing I didn't know that You might have seen sparks. You see, they see like these sparkler sparks going off when launch.
Sparky sparks.
Sparkly sparks. They do that to burn. They do that to burn hydrogen that might have vented and to prevent any problems.
So I thought that those ignited the engines.
No. It's to burn off any harmful gases that might ignite.
No, they throw a match at it. That's how they started up, Jay.
Okay, only one president has ever witnessed a shuttle launch. That was Bill Clinton.
I was going to guess Roosevelt.
But in fairness to Obama, he was scheduled to see a launch, and it was delayed, of course, but he still went to the on-site. Otherwise, he would have seen it as well. So that's one.
If I was the president, I would be like, I want to go to every single launch. Like sit in the booth, you know.
Can you imagine the security just to get the
president
down?
You're the
president. Down there? I know. But one launch would be nice.
If you were the president, you would have demanded it take off no matter what. but sir, it's going to explode. I don't care.
I want that rocket off.
Thank you both. Thank you.
Steve, one more quick one. This one was interesting. An Xbox 360 has more power than the flight computer on the shuttle, which I thought was kind of surprising.
Wait, that had to be the original, not now.
No, right now. And it's for two reasons, though. NASA, of course, is obsessed with reliability. I mean, the computer systems or the software that they're using has been reliable for decades.
So they're still using DOS, is what you're saying, in the shuttle.
No one ever said DOS was reliable, Steve.
Pseudo make shuttle go.
But it's a Clipper app.
So there's two reasons, though. Of course, there's reliability, and I mean, they're still obviously very cutting edge, and the astronauts are allowed to bring laptops. So there is a lot of computing power on board, but the flight computer itself is very old.
No, you can't whistle when you're in a space shuttle.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Not when you're in a shuttle.
No. Oh, it's a spacesuit.
When you're on a spacewalk, you can't.
Yeah, get it right, Jay.
That was from last night.
All right, let's move on. Jay, tell us why this guy is what is it? Who is this guy and what is he doing?
Well, who out there knows what's going on here? Go ahead, stand up, sir. Okay, so what our friend just said was you need, in your driver's license photo in Australia, you need...
Austria.
Oh, my God. Sorry, Richard. So sorry. So only in New Zealand can you wear...
Tasmania, get it right.
So a guy named Nico decided, for his own reasons, because he wanted to basically, I would just consider this more of like just pulling a prank, he wanted to make it so he could wear his religious headgear in his driver's license photo. And the only way you're allowed to do that is if you can prove that your religion requires the headgear. And he did. And he took him 3 years to do it. And he proved that, yes, indeed, he is a Pastafarian. He's wearing a strainer on his head.
Pasta strainer.
Sounds like we have some Pastafarians in the audience.
The authorities required him, that they were really giving him a hard time about it. They made him go and get a medical exam to make sure that he wasn't
a psychiatric
crazy.
Evaluation.
Yeah. So they deemed him psychologically fit.
But what I want to know is, do they make everyone who asks for this exception get a psychiatric evaluation?
They should.
Regardless of what faith.
Yeah. But we at the SGU looked at this picture and we were like, lame. First of all, you don't see any holes in the freaking thing. And he literally, like, zero interest. I'd be like, yeah, you know.
It was totally anticlimactic. I wanted to see a picture of a non-believer with a pasta strainer on their head. I mean, come on, this is the best they could do. You guys heard of organic water?
Yummy.
I was shocked. I mean, of course you have to have organic water. So the obvious question is, what is organic water?
It was raised on a farm.
It was...
To free range.
It's free range. Free range water.
No pesticides.
Raised by the Amish.
It's got organ parts in it.
This is not orgasmic water.
So it's water without bad stuff. Right? There's no chemicals except for water in there. And it was pulled out of the ground as opposed to all the other water.
Wait, so is this being sold somewhere?
There's multiple companies now. So the organic now is a good marketing term. Whatever you think it means, it's a marketing term now. So organic water. It's water that is, you know, it's water. So you know this is Bob's news item, right? And you look at a picture, there's like... There's molecules and stuff on it. What is that, Bob?
That's graphene and water.
So I heard someone in the audience get that, actually.
Yeah,
that
graphene is it organic water?
But also, stop talking. We're up here. Come on. Yeah.
Well, scientists have shown recently that two very common substances, carbon and water, if you put them together in just the right way, it could actually replicate what lithium-ion batteries can do, which is pretty impressive. But the most impressive thing about this is that using this new material, this new type of battery, it could potentially recharge a battery in 2 seconds, 2 or 3 seconds, just a few moments. And it could also recharge the same battery indefinitely, over and over and over. So yet again, we've got another new battery technology that's going to be revolutionary, that probably will fade away in a few weeks and we'll never hear about it again. But it's still fascinating to talk about and to think about the technology behind it. Now, one of the main scientists behind this is Dan Lee of the Monash University Department of Materials and Engineering. And he was recently quoted as saying, "Once we can properly manipulate this material, your iPhone, for example, could charge in a few seconds or possibly faster." So that was the one quote that really grabbed me when I read that. I mean, walking through the convention the past few days, I'm constantly seeing people sitting down with their smartphone, and it's plugged in and they're charging because they forgot to charge it. They've been surfing the web a lot and the battery's dead. And so this, to me, that would be, I can barely even imagine being able to just plug in my phone and 2 seconds later walk away and having it be fully charged. That would be pretty amazing if this ever works. But now one of the key players here for this technology is graphene. The form of carbon, the allotrope of carbon that they're using for this is graphene, which has been called a wonder material. It's basically, if you take graphite and you process it in such a way that you create these one atom thick layer of sheets, kind of like a chicken wire fence, and it's got these amazing properties that there's been so many predictions about it. We've talked about it on the show a few times. People are saying that it's better than silicon for computer circuits. They say that it could be the foundation for supercapacitors, and it could also extend Moore's law. So there's lots of hope in this material, and hopefully this is another application that might pan out. But it's really unusual. It's not a semiconductor, it's not an insulator, it's not a metal. It's kind of like this weird semi-metal substance that's got amazing electronic properties. It's also chemically stable, and it's very strong. It's carbon. But the key attribute, though, of graphene is the fact that it has incredible surface area. As you could imagine, these tiny little sheets that are only one atom thick, it's got amazing surface area. But that's also part of the problem, though, is that when you take these sheets of graphene and they get in your building or macroscopic structure, when they get close, they just bond right together, and then there goes your surface area. Imagine a notebook with like 100 sheets of paper all separated out. That's a lot of surface area because you're looking at each piece of paper, top and bottom. That's a lot of surface area. But if you collapse it together, you've got a notebook with just a top and a bottom, and I guess the sides, too. So that's very bad for battery technology. So they had a pretty interesting insight, an interesting resolution to this problem. Yes.
You've talked for 2 minutes and 20 seconds, and you haven't breathed once.
Thanks, Jay.
I thought I'd help you.
I thought you were going to warn me at 1 minute.
Take a breath.
All right. So their solution to the problem was to use water. They infuse the graphene with water, which kind of soaks in between these sheets and repels the surfaces so that it creates this graphene gel, and that's going to be the basis of the battery. This has so many beneficial properties. You could scale this. It's very simple because it's just carbon and water. Like I said, it's going to scale. You can create batteries that are, I guess, pretty big using this technology. And it can also, apparently, it should be able to recharge batteries in moments. So cross your fingers on this one, and hopefully this one will pan out. And if not, I'm sure there'll be another news item next week about battery technology.
Where are they with this, Bob? They don't have a working model yet. It's just that this is theoretical. They just made the gel.
I think they made the gel. The articles I read were not much information on details like that. I was very disappointed that they didn't actually say where they were, but it looks promising, and that's pretty much all I can say at this point. And it should work. It makes sense, and I think they're not too much further past the gel stage and testing it.
Yeah. This is a news item we've come to a couple of times, and the question is, why did the dinosaurs go extinct? Right. This is one of the first science questions that little kids get involved with. They love dinosaurs, and the fact that they're not around anymore is the immediate question. Where did they go? Why did they die out? The consensus opinion that I think the public believes is that they were wiped out by an asteroid that smacked into the Earth. The Yucatan Peninsula threw up a cloud of dust and blocked out the sun for years and or months, and wiped out 90% of life on Earth. But within the paleontological community, there's actually a raging controversy around that. Is that really what happened? Because when paleontologists look at the fossil record of dinosaurs, they find that the closer you get to the boundary layer, what used to be called the KT boundary, and is now called the KPG boundary, where you have that iridium layer, that layer of dust from the impact. Clearly there was a large impact at that time. There's dinosaur fossils below that line. There are no dinosaur fossils above that line. But as you get closer to that line, there are fewer and fewer dinosaur bones.
Steve, KPG, what are you talking about? They changed the name of the KT boundary to KPG?
You didn't get the memo?
What? I missed that. Why would they change the name? I like KT.
It's the now it's the Cretaceous Paleogene separation. I wasn't at the meeting. I don't know. Yeah, it's not a brontosaurus anymore either. Don't get me started on Hardikotherium. So that makes it look as if dinosaurs were dying out and that the impact was just the coup de grace, right? Not the coup de grace, but the coup de grace. And that was the final nail in the coffin that killed the dinosaurs. So that's the controversy. Were the dinosaurs already on their way out, or is that an artifact of the fossil record, and it really was just this one impact that wiped them out? That controversy has been in the news recently because of a discovery of the youngest dinosaur fragment to date. So the closer we can find dinosaur fossils to the boundary, the less it looks like the dinosaurs were on their way out, and the more it looks like they really all went extinct right at the boundary. So this is an important discovery, you know, pushing the dinosaur fossils closer to that KPG boundary. So that's the news item. It was apparently the eyebrow of a Triceratops. They say a Triceratops or a Torosaurus, which is yet another paleontological controversy. Is a Torosaurus an adult Triceratops? Are they the same species or are they two separate species? But anyway, they just ignored that in this article by saying Triceratops or Torosaurus. But it was very, very close to the KPG boundary. So this has not resolved the debate, though. So the paleontologists who are on the side of the single impact theory said, see, this is what we predicted. We're going to find more and more fossils closer to the boundary. The paleontologists on the either the multi-cause hypothesis or that they were already on their way out says there is still a paucity of fossils as you get close to the boundary. This does not resolve the debate. It's just one tiny piece of evidence. So we're going to continue to read about this. What interests me is that this debate is occurring within the paleontological community, and it does not filter down to the public awareness. The public thinks it's an asteroid. That's it. There's no debate or no issue about it. Right? How many people here knew there was a controversy about the single impact?
You people. Yeah, but you guys are weird.
How many of you here knew that dinosaurs existed?
Three, okay.
It's in the Bible.
See, those are my people, Steve.
Yeah, we know. This brings us to the Q&A portion of our first show for TAM9. And we will bring out our lovely MC.
If you'd like to ask a question, we're going to line up right over there.
How do you lose your hair?
Well, you can't ask me a question. You have to ask them a question. Really? That's the. I was wondering if you could tell us what you think have been some of the skeptical wins in the last year. Are there success stories that you can remember?
Wow.
Power balance was a big one in Australia, getting power balance. Round of applause for the Austrians.
They want the power balance.
Not just because he's my brother, but I thought it was really badass that Steve got on Dr. Oz's show and held his own.
You don't really worry about it.
I actually have to say that the editing was very fair. It could have been a train wreck.
And Charlie Sheen's implosion, I think, is a win for the skeptical community.
Well, for the 24-hour SGU that you guys are planning, I've been burning with curiosity. What kind of stimulants will you be using? Legal?
Don't think for a second. First of all, I disagree with this project. But we've actually been talking about how we're going to deal with it because we're... All right, I'm sorry. That's right. Thank you, George. We planned... Somebody came up with this idea that we're going to do a 24-hour live video audio podcast. And we're building a set. We're going way beyond our budget to pull something like this off, to try to do something, fun for you guys and definitely not for us. And we're going to stay awake for 24 hours, and one of the issues is...
Going to appear to stay awake for 24 hours.
Yeah. Steve wants us to start at 8 p.m.,
that day. And I'm saying let's start at like, you know, 8 a.m.
Let's not have this fight again. We're starting at 8 p.m.
I think it's important because I don't want to be awake for 36 hours. Anyway, thank you, sir. But, we'll work it out.
To answer your question, I'll be employing the Korean hand therapy for me.
Right. A proprietary blend.
What kind of perverted...
The Korean hand therapy. Come on, Rebecca. Keep up.
Whatever.
We'll fill you in later.
So tell me, please, how does one reconcile skepticism with a belief in God? Not that God has to necessarily be measured and quantified, but for someone that has a belief in God, how do you reconcile healthy skepticism with that?
10 seconds, go.
10 seconds. Okay.
Well, I can answer that in 10 seconds. The brain's ability to compartmentalize. None of us are perfect skeptics. We haven't all rooted out every last tiny, weird, superstitious belief. And skepticism is a tool we use. We apply it to various beliefs. Some of us apply it to every belief that we can think of, and some people don't want to apply it to religion. Some people do apply it and still come to the decision that there is a God. So
yeah, I mean, the other answer is, so compartmentalization is one way. The other way is rationalization, which I was talking about before. We're very good at constructing a reason to justify our beliefs. And you know, I think the deist position is probably the closest you can get to reconciling, you know, philosophically, you know, skepticism or rationalism with a belief in a deity, which is essentially the notion that there is. Perhaps, you know, just naked belief in something that we can't know exists, that's beyond the natural world, but it's not based upon knowledge or evidence or science. It's just, you just choose to believe in it, you know, and it completely walled off from the world of science and skepticism. That's the way you can sort of at least make them not directly conflate.
Martin Gardner
was that type of deist, right.
And you could also apply that to a belief in Smurfs, if you choose.
Yeah. If you choose to believe in Smurfs, yes.
Phew. Next question.
I'm going to get an angry email about that.
My fiance went, or now she's my wife. We're actually here on our honeymoon. She went to go get some massage therapy, and at the end of it, they gave her a pamphlet for what was called craniosacral therapy.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, we looked it up, and we're both biologists, so we were able to figure out very quickly.
Figure out that the bones of the skull have fused together, and they cannot be manipulated. That you figured out.
Yeah. To quickly explain what this is, it's basically a chiropractic adjustment on the skull. And if you watch a video of somebody doing it, which I have because it's really funny, the doctor goes up and he goes like this, like that. You know, he's like, huh. And nothing happens. The guy's head doesn't move or anything. He's just kind of like doing this. And then he showed pictures of, like, you know, when the bones of the top of the skull fuse, there's like a little lip there. And then he showed another picture, and they were like more rounded. And there's no way that a little huh like that is going to change your skull. Yeah, literally, you'd have to go in and cut it with a saw.
Yeah, so it's not science-based. The basic premise is massively flawed. So it is an unscientific practice, and yeah, that information is available. The biggest flaw is that you can't manipulate the fused bones of the skull.
Yeah, right. Shame on that spa.
Right. A spa, I'm shocked. The spa promoting pseudoscientific practice.
Hi, guys. Hey. I love science, and you guys love science.
And we love you.
Right. Oh, awesome, yeah. And I like jokes, and I assume you guys like jokes. I'm just wondering if you could go down the line, and what's your favorite science jokes, science-y, skeptic-y jokes?
Man. Jay, would you like to start?
Absolutely. A neutron walks into a bar and asks, "How much for a drink?" And the bartender replies, "Go F yourself." I got you on that one.
Bob, you're next.
Okay. A physicist walks into an ice cream parlor, sits down, and orders himself ice cream, and he orders another ice cream, and he puts it, and he offers it to the empty stool next to him. And he does that every day for about a week, and the owner finally approaches him and says, "What's the deal with this? Why do you order for somebody that's not there?" And the physicist said, "Well, quantum mechanics teaches us that because of quantum tunneling, it's possible that particles can spontaneously appear in the form of a woman next to me, and hopefully she would accept my offer and maybe fall in love with me. So the owner of the ice cream parlor said, well, hey, girls come in here every day. Why not just approach one of the girls that show up every day and ask them? Maybe she will accept your offer and fall in love with you. And the physicist said, well, yeah, but what are the odds of that happening?
This is my new favorite science joke submitted by a listener. And Adam came back from a weight clinic feeling depressed and was talking to a friend. You should keep an eye on me. Eye on you? Yes, I gained a couple electrons and I'm feeling kind of negative. Thank you, random listener. Thank you.
So the bartender says, go F yourself.
Steve, do you have one?
Yes, I do. I have a medical joke. It has to be a medical joke. Apologies to all of my colleagues out there for this one. So an internist, a neurologist, a surgeon, and a pathologist are going duck hunting. Stop me if you've heard this one. And they only have a license to shoot ducks, so they got to be careful. So they set up in their blind, and they agree they're going to take turns. So it's the internist's turn first. A flock of birds comes by, and the internist goes, oh, look, ducks. Then he turns to the neurologist to his side. What do you think? Do you think those are ducks? And then he turns to the surgeon. How about you? You think those are ducks? Before he was through consulting his colleagues, the flock had flown by and he had missed his chance. Then the next flight comes by and it's the neurologist's turn and he goes, ooh, a flight of ducks. Wait, but they could be geese or maybe even grouse. So by the time he got through going through his differential diagnosis, the flock had flown by and he had missed his chance. So now the surgeon is up. Another flock of birds comes by. Without hesitation, the surgeon raises his shotgun, empties both barrels, blam, blam. There are birds, parts flying everywhere, birds falling into the lake. He grabs the rifle from the neurologist to his right, empties those barrels until the birds are gone and there's just carnage in the lake. And he turns to the pathologist to his left and goes, make sure those were ducks.
True story.
You've been critical of Sam Harris's writings in the past. Have you read anything more by him, and have your opinions changed?
So, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to. I think that the bit that I've been critical about Sam Harris is the notion that you can objectively, scientifically come to a system of values. And what I say is, yeah, you know, you can use science and reason to inform an ethical value system, but not to decide what the right values are. There's always a subjective component in there that cannot be fully eliminated. And I think that that's where we part ways a little bit. It's kind of a philosophical discussion. And I think he's kept to that in his recent writings. So I haven't read anything recently that would change that disagreement.
We got time for one more question.
Hi, guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller. How did SGU get its start?
The SGU got its start because of a man called Perry DeAngelis. It was his idea for us to start a skeptical organization, and everything else flowed from there. The SGU itself was my idea, and it's kind of a long story, but the short version is, we ended our online gaming night, which was Wednesday night we would play an online game together. And when we stopped doing that, I said, well, all right, instead of going on to another game, let's do a podcast.
That's not true. A friend of ours emailed us.
Well, I'm giving the short version, Jay. You're giving the, yes. And that happened at the same time that a friend of ours said, hey, have you guys heard of this podcast thing? Which we hadn't. You know, what is that? This is right at the beginning. He said, hey, you know, let's do a podcast of our political discussions, because we have all these political talks. Yeah, so I said, that's a great idea, except we're going to do a skeptical podcast. And so that sort of happened at the same time that our Wednesday nights opened up, and the SGU came from that.
And then we moved our gaming night to Monday night. And I'm not kidding.
We did. And our wives were thrilled about that.
Oh, yeah.
How's the podcast worked out? Is it working for you?
It's still a work in progress, you know.
It's time for Science or
fiction.
It's time for science or fiction. Now, last night, we had our auction at the SGU dinner, and we auctioned off the right to sit up here on stage with us for the science or fiction, and that was won by Nick Hilton. So, Nick, I told you to sit close to the front. Now's the time to come up. Here we go. All right, Nick, have a seat right here.
Hello, everyone.
Nick, where are you from?
I am from Iowa originally, but I'm living in San Diego now.
Awesome. Is this your first ham?
This is my first ham.
First hammer.
Not bad.
One ham and already you're up on stage. Awesome. All right, well, let's get going. I'm going to read. This is going to work. I'm going to read out the three items. We do things in the live shows a little bit differently. We solicit feedback from the audience, and then we see if the panel can influence your decisions. But there's an extra element to this. Bob and Rebecca have been doing a challenge over the last 3 weeks to see who could, over 4 weeks, who would have the best science or fiction record. And as of right now, they are tied. 2 wins and 1 loss each. So this is the tiebreaker. And so if they both either win or both lose today, we'll have a lightning round to make sure that that there actually is a winner. So and the loser will have their punishment meted out right here up on stage after science or fiction. So what we're going to do to make this fair is Bob and Rebecca are going to write their answers down prior to any other feedback and give them to me. So you won't be influencing them and nobody else will influence them. So the items have been up there, but let me read them out. New research indicates that access to information via the internet, such as through Google, decreases people's ability to recall information. Item number 2, the Wildlife Conservation Society has recently declared that the snow leopard is now likely extinct in the wild. Item number 3, models of the orbits of the large asteroids Ceres and Vesta indicate that Earth's climate cannot be traced back more than 60 million years. In other words, because of information we learned about the orbits of those asteroids, we cannot model the Earth's climate back farther than 60 million years. So Bob and Rebecca, please record your answers and pass those down to me. So by applause, we are going to now see what you guys think in the audience, right? So you should applaud for the one that you think is the fiction. So how many people in the audience think that number one about Google making you dumb is the fiction?
Okay.
How many think that the snow leopard is extinct is the fiction? And how many think that the asteroid Ceres and Vesta somehow are affecting our ability on the climate? Okay, so it sounds like 3-2-1, if I get that correct. So, as our guest...
Nick, you get to go first.
Okay. Well, I know using Google that I always forget things, and I can never remember it, so I always say I'll go Google that. Like, I never bookmark anything anymore, I just Google it. So I think that one is true. I would be really sad to think if the snow leopard is gone in the wild, but unfortunately I think that one is also true. But number 3, I don't see how these objects orbiting the Earth could possibly influence our ability to measure the climate 60 million years ago. I think it's more to do with the evidence on the Earth, so I'm going to go with number 3 as being the fiction.
Okay, you're agreeing with the audience. Evan, what do you think?
I am also going to agree with Nick and the audience. I believe that the models of the orbits of the large asteroid Ceres and Vesta about the climate is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Well, I definitely think that Bob and Rebecca picked number 3.
And therefore...
And these guys picked 3, so I'm definitely going with number 1.
Is Google making you dumb, you think?
Yeah, the Google one.
Yeah, right.
You talking to me?
All right, Rebecca, what did you choose?
Actually, It was between 2 and 3 for me, because I agree, you know, I Google things instead of remembering them, so that makes perfect sense. Although sometimes that's a hint. When it makes perfect sense, that means it's the fiction. But, you know, 3 baffles me completely, so I'm not really sure. I mean, yeah, it doesn't seem to make sense, but it's the second one that I was drawn to, because I could have sworn, and I might be completely misremembering this, but I thought that we actually got video of snow leopards fairly recently caught on camera. So
that was at the zoo.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, that was me at the zoo. I feel like it was done for a documentary, and I might just be completely misremembering that, and maybe it was a different animal entirely, but that's the one I went with.
That was the snoo leopard.
The snoo leopard? How could they go extinct? Okay, so like 5 Futurama fans. That's good.
So you think the snow leopard is the figure?
Yeah, that's the one I went with.
And Bob, what did you choose?
Rebecca, I hope you're misremembering. One seemed pretty obvious to me. I remember reading a while back about Google and search engines allowing people to hop from website to website so quickly and so effortlessly that our retention is affected. So that made perfect sense to me. The second one, I really had no solid thoughts on the snow leopard. I hadn't read anything, I hadn't seen anything, I hadn't heard anything about snow leopards in so long. I really had no idea of what was going on with that one. And the third one, like everyone else, made no sense. I can't think of any connection between the orbits of these asteroids and the climate on Earth. And there's still got to be ways to infer Earth's climate beyond 60 million years. Fossilized evidence of climate. There's got to be ways that are retained after 60 million years. I'm not sure why that would be some magic number that would, beyond that we could have no clue. So I went with number 3, and that made the most sense to me. But maybe, we'll see what happens. Good.
We'll see what happens. All right. So very quickly, we'll see what influence our panel of experts had on the audience. So again, how many people in the audience think that the Google makes you dumb is the fiction? Even fewer. Even fewer. How many people think that the snow leopard is extinct as the fiction? Rebecca was a little influential there.
Little.
And how many people think that the asteroids affecting our ability to know the climate is the fiction? Well, we'll start with the first one, since most people think that one is science. New research indicates that access to information via the internet, such as through Google, decreases people's ability to recall information, and that one is science. So far, so good for both of our players and for the audience. Well done. What researchers have found, in fact, is that people are better at remembering how to access information, where to search, and how to search for information, but they are less able to recall the information itself. So we are allocating our finite cognitive resources to our external, essentially, keeping of information on the internet, and we are storing less of that information here. We're basically using up our resources to access the external store of data and keeping less of that store of data in our own brain. That was the implication of the research. Basically, they found that people are less able to recall the information itself. So that one is science. I guess we'll take these in order. Number 2, the Wildlife Conservation Society has recently declared that the snow leopard is now likely extinct in the wild. The only one on our panel to think this one is the fiction is Rebecca. Maybe a third of the audience, by applause, thinks that this one is the fiction. And this one is...
the fiction.
Ooh. I'm screwed.
You were a good opponent, Bob. Good opponent.
In fact, the Wildlife Conservation Society has surprisingly discovered a healthy population of rare snow leopards living in the mountainous reaches of northeastern Afghanistan. They think there is between 4,500 and 7,500 snow leopards remaining in the world, and so adding this new, stable, fairly large population that we didn't know about before actually is a very good thing. It makes them much more viable.
I don't know if the applause was for me or the snow leopards, but I'll accept on behalf of all of us. Thank you.
So that all of this means that models of the orbits of the large asteroids Ceres and Vesta indicate that Earth's climate cannot be traced back more than 60 million years is science. I had a hard time figuring out how to word this one concisely, which is why I gave a little bit of an explanation afterwards, but this one is science. This is going to be my lightning round thing. You guys know the probe that is now currently investigating Ceres and Vesta?
Yeah.
The Dawn probe.
Yeah.
The Dawn probe, right. What they found is that the asteroids, so Ceres and Vesta are among the largest asteroids in the asteroid belt, and careful modeling of their orbits indicates that there are perturbations in the orbit, and over long stretches of time, they don't average out. Their orbits actually change over time. And because they are being tugged by the planets and each other, that these perturbations are chaotic. They cannot be modeled by computers. So we can't model back more than 60 million years or so what the effects they would have on orbital mechanics, including the orbit of the Earth. And they do affect the eccentricity of the Earth. And since the eccentricity of the Earth affects the climate, and we can't, as Bob, because it's chaos, Bob, we cannot infer beyond around 60 million years, again, according to these current now models of these orbits, we therefore cannot know the influence of the eccentricity of Earth's orbit on its climate, and therefore we can't model climate. We can maybe directly measure it, but that's not what I said, but we can't trace or model the climate beyond this chaotic limit of knowing the orbit of the Earth. So I know you're all dying to know what the punishment is.
Yeah, because we don't know. Bob and I have not been informed.
I'm freaking out a little bit.
Yeah, so George helped us concoct this. It was a group effort. We were racking our brains, and then we came up with the idea. The whole thing was George. George, is this all your idea? Yes, it was, George says. So I came up with this idea that, okay, so the bottom line is, I have a script here taken from one of the first three Star Wars movies, which includes Jar Jar Binks.
No.
And Qui-Gon. Because Bob lost, actually, we could let Rebecca pick, but I think it would be funnier if Bob did Jar Jar.
Yeah, loser does Jar Jar.
I'll let Bob be Jar Jar.
Right. The wrinkle is, Bob... You have to read this like Jar Jar.
I don't have to do anything, Jay.
No, you do. That's the deal.
And you know I'm terrible at accents.
Begin.
Wait, am I the frog-like creature? I've never seen this movie.
No.
Look. Wait. It's not like I don't love CBBO, but...
or R3-D4,
What's stats? What's a stat?
That's stage direction. Just forget about that. Anything that doesn't have your character's name in front of it, don't worry about it.
And I'm Qui-Gon.
Qui-Gon.
Qui-Gon. Jay, I saw this movie once, like, how many years ago?
Just read the dialogue.
I mean, what did he sound like? I kind of forget, Jay. What did you charge?
Like a racist caricature.
I'll give you
really,
I'll give
Jay
you
should be reading this.
Misa plays science and fictionsies.
There you go. That's it. Go with it.
All right. What's he saying here? What does this
Bob,
mean?
Come on. Just phonetically say the words.
All right.
Sound it out.
Okay. Oi, mooey, mooey, I love yous.
Are you brainless? You almost got us killed.
I spake.
The ability to speak does not make you intelligent. Now get out of here.
No, Misa, stay. Misa, you humble servant. I'm going to kill Jay. George.
Thanks, George.
That won't be necessary.
Oh, boo, tis demanded by the gods. Is that gods? Guds?
Keep going.
All right. Tis a live debit, Tis. Mesa called Jacobingus. Wow, that's pathetic. Go ahead. Get this over with, quickly.
This is actually the character saying this, not me, but I have no time for this now.
Say what?
That's you.
No. Yep. Oh, I go again. Continue. Oh, no, Wisa Ghana.
Wait, there are many O's in that.
Oh, no, Wisa Ghana. Thanks, Rebecca.
Stay down.
Die!
Yeah.
I feel like we both lost.
Yeah.
Everyone lost. Everyone lost.
Dude, what? I thought we were buds. All right, I still love you. I still love you. So I had the absolute ridiculous pleasure of meeting in person Bill Nye today. And yes. And I was going to look up a quote from Bill because some of you may know, Bill is the reason why I shout the quote out. So I didn't have to look up a quote. This is what Bill said while we were interviewing him. Bill said, "Science is the best thing that humankind ever came up with. And if it isn't, science will fix it."
Give it up for the SGU, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.